the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa Yeah.
the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is he that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not. And He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Deadline's political crisis deepens in Lebanon after the resignation of Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri, with protests erupting in Beirut. A search operation is underway to find more than 1,300 people missing in Germany's west after record rainfall caused huge flooding there. Also coming up, a Canadian Indigenous group says more unmarked graves are expected as it identifies some 200 potential burial sites near a former residential school. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story: Lebanon's political crisis deepens after Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri failed to form a new government and announced his resignation. Hariri stepped down on Thursday after a meeting with President Michel Aoun. He has accused Aoun of hampering the process of forming a new government. Hariri told Lebanese media that he would be unable to run the country with a cabinet that Aoun wants. In response, the president's office said Hariri was not ready to discuss any kind of amendments to his proposed cabinet. Meanwhile, protests have broken out in the capital, Beirut, where protesters clashed with security forces. A number of people have been injured. Lebanon's last government was forced to resign last August after a deadly explosion in Beirut. The country is also facing an economic crisis. Mariam Saleh in Beirut explains why Hariri and Aoun were unable to agree on a cabinet lineup.
This is what we know from sources, that the names did not change. What he did was add a few names, as the president asked. The president asked him to be more flexible, to have better representation of the sects, because this is stipulated by the constitution, and this is based on the fact that in the parliament we are represented as such. So as long as we have a sectarian system, we're going to have to represent them through the cabinet. And this cabinet is supposed to go through several issues that are very significant when it comes to accountability and corruption and so on. And President Aoun did not believe that those names can actually go ahead with those issues, because they are part of the same elite that caused the economic crisis. And this also is evidence when we see that the ambassadors of the U.S. and France were pushing for those names. They were pushing for that list, and they put pressure on President Aoun to accept that list as it is.
Israel's new Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has relaunched the controversial project to construct over 3,400 settler units in the occupied West Bank. The so-called E1 project involves construction of the units at an area where hundreds of Palestinians live in Bedouin communities. Mona Candido reports.
Israel has advanced a major settler building project known as E1. Israel's new Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched the controversial project for the construction of over 3,412 settler units in the occupied West Bank to connect the largest Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim to the West Jerusalem Al-Quds. The project was first pushed forward by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinians have slammed the move as seriously dangerous.
Now, as Bennett brings it on the table, it is just to show the settlers that he's better than Netanyahu. He's continued the main strategy and the ideology of the settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu has been freezing or a little bit slowed down the working in the E1, but they are now pushing it forward. This is a very dangerous colonial project in the West Bank. This will be totally cut off and divided the West Bank between the north and the south. So it's very sensitive, very strategic.
Israeli authorities have been seeking to expel tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins to other Palestinian towns since long time ago because the area has been allocated to E1 settlement constructions. This area sits on roughly 15 square kilometers of land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. For years, the Israeli regime has tried to dismantle the Bedouin communities to make way for its massive E1 settlement project in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The planned Israeli building in E1 would effectively cut the West Bank in half and prevent Palestinian sovereign contiguity between northern and southern West Bank.
The project comes in line with Israel's annexation plan. The new regime in Israel is seeking to disrupt any territorial integrity of a future Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders. To this end, it displaces more Palestinians in violation of all international laws.
Palestinians say that it's very clear that Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu, as he started rapidly to carry out his agenda to expand illegal settlements in the occupied territories even more vigorously.
During Netanyahu's term in office, Israeli-only roads were built as first step in constructing settlements in the controversial E1 zone. Now Bennett has revived the plan and the actual construction for E1. Palestinians warned this project would practically cut the occupied West Bank in half. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Now, the Taliban have offered a three-month ceasefire to the Afghan government in exchange for the release of 7,000 of its inmates held in Afghanistan jails. Amin Alami reports from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
As a delegation of high-ranking officials from Afghanistan is expected to visit Doha to resume their long-delayed intra-Afghan talks with the Taliban, the militant group has proposed a three-month ceasefire in return for the release of 7,000 Taliban inmates from Afghan jails.
The government has not directly reacted to Taliban's recent offer of a three-month ceasefire, but officials have called on the militants to approach the peace process with honesty.
The proposal comes as a large number of the 5,000 Taliban inmates released recently have returned to the battlefields. That is why many have called on the government to adopt stricter measures while studying the militants' proposal.
We have already seen how the release of 5,000 Taliban prisoners further fueled the war here. So, this time, the government must not trust the militant group unless it receives strong international guarantees.
Many others view the offer as a political tactic by the Taliban to gain more time to both properly control the captured districts and recruit more militants to strengthen its armed front.
Taliban are after other goals rather than peace and security. They have captured dozens of districts in key border areas over the recent months, so they need more time to fully control the captured areas. Taliban also seek to increase their forces by releasing more prisoners.
In the meantime, the government officials believe there would be no win for anyone in Afghanistan via war and bloodshed. Therefore, they call on the Taliban to respect the will of war-weary Afghans and honestly approve a lasting peace to the war-ravaged Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Turning elsewhere, hundreds of people remain missing in Germany after record rainfall caused huge floodings there. A search operation is underway to find more than 1,300 people missing in Germany's west. Authorities say over 80 people have lost their lives. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has called the flooding a catastrophe. Her country is the worst affected state by the ongoing flooding in Western Europe. That's the worst in recent history there. Belgium has confirmed at least 9 deaths. Luxembourg and the Netherlands have all evacuated thousands of people. More heavy rain is forecast across the region on Friday. Experts have blamed climate change for the huge floods. The United States and Germany have pledged to stand up to what they have called Russian aggression. The pledge was made during a meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Washington. The two also discussed the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that's under construction to transfer gas from Russia to Germany. The U.S. president said he has misgivings about the project. Biden said he and Merkel were united in their belief that Russia should not use energy as a weapon. Russia in the past has rejected such claims. It has been at odds with the West over a range of issues, including activities that Russia sees as threatening to its security. A Canadian Indigenous group says it expects more graves to be found near a former residential school where 215 unmarked graves have already been discovered. The group called on the government and the Catholic Church, which ran the school, to release records to help identify the graves near the Kamloops Indian Residential School. It noted that ground surveying research in areas close to school shows there could be more, as many as 200 potential burial sites there. The group added that the number could increase as much of the area has not been surveyed yet. So far, more than 1,100 graves have been discovered at the former residential schools across the country. The Canadian government has admitted that physical and sexual abuse was rampant in the schools. Author and journalist Robert Fantina says the Canadian government must do its utmost to make up for the experiences the First Nations have gone through.
These innocent children and their families suffered horrifically. The children were ripped from their families under penalty. That was the law at the time. And then these innocent children were abused physically, sexually, emotionally, separated from their families, separated from their culture, their language, and all this among the most horrendous abuse that one can imagine. The Canadian government can't undo this, but it can do everything possible to find the victims, to aid the survivors, and to compensate the First Nations people for the horrible things the government did to them.
Colombia's police helping Haiti in the investigation of President Jovenel Moïse's assassination have made new revelations about the operation, saying the initial intention of the gunmen was to capture the president alive.
The captured Colombian ex-military officers claim that the plan was to arrest the president and hand him over to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. The information we have is that they would have been divided into two groups of approximately 7 Colombians, the first entering the house of the president and the others providing security.
Colombian police added that they are now looking for 3 people who have been in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Meanwhile, Haitian police said the murder was planned in the neighboring Dominican Republic. They announced that the main bodyguard and 3 other members of the slain president's security staff were arrested. Colombian intelligence agents are cooperating with Haitian authorities in investigating the July 7th murder of Moïse. 2 Americans of Haitian descent and 26 Colombians took part in the operation at the president's home in Port-au-Prince. Political commentator Leo Sazdi says those who plotted to assassinate President Jovenel Moïse want to deceive the investigators and public opinion.
It looks like whoever ordered this crime, the murder of the president of Haiti, wanted whoever, no, investigators, public opinion, to get the wrong idea of who might be really behind the murder. Using Colombians, then the first impression will be, well, that maybe those who ordered the murder came from Colombia. That the idea was, for the plan was created or brainstormed, let's say, in Colombia, which I don't think. I mean, everything is possible, but I'll try to explain myself.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says the situation of Eritrean refugees living in Ethiopia's Tigray region is rapidly worsening. The agency voiced concern over the escalation of fighting in the region in the past days. It said tens of thousands of Eritrean refugees are now fearful for their lives due to the insecurity and ongoing movement of troops in the area. Local fighters in Tigray have been engaged in a conflict with government troops in the area since last November. Nearly 100,000 refugees from Eritrea were living in camps in the area when the fighting erupted. The South African government says 117 people have been killed in the country's week-long unrest as security forces struggle to quell the violence. The figure shows a sharp rise from the toll of 72 announced the previous day. A government official said the commercial hub of Johannesburg was now relatively calm. However, the KwaZulu-Natal province remains volatile. Meanwhile, South Africa's army is preparing to deploy 25,000 troops to assist police in tackling the emergency. South Africa plunged into chaos after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself in to serve a 15-month jail term for contempt of court. Authorities say hundreds of people have been arrested in connection with looting, arson, and violence.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after he defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa. Amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
Wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
Global aid groups rebuked the Tory-led UK government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson for approving a plan to slash overseas aid spending by £4 billion per year, with critics saying the cuts would result in disastrous consequences for the world's poorest people, including millions of children in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, says Julia Conley Ryder, In an article published under the heading, A Truly Shameful Day, UK Government Condemned for Slashing Global Aid During Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Global aid groups rebuked the Tory-led UK government of Prime Minister Boris Johnson for approving a plan to slash overseas aid spending by £4 billion, or $5.5 billion per year, with critics saying the cuts would result in disastrous consequences for the world's poorest people, including millions of children in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. Johnson's plan was met with outrage from some members of his own Conservative Party, but only 24 Tories ultimately voted against the proposal. A number of Tories who had originally said they disapproved of the plan to cut international spending from 0.7% to 0.5% of national income eventually joined most of the party in supporting the proposal after accepting a compromise from Chancellor Rishi Sunak, stating that the cuts will be reversed once government debt is decreased and the country no longer has to borrow to fund daily spending, a position the UK has not been in since 1970, Open Democracy reported. MPs should not be fooled, tweeted Global Justice Now ahead of the vote. Unless they vote against the aid cuts today, this government will never reverse them. Under the plan, aid to Syria could be cut by two-thirds, to Libya by 63%, to Somalia and the Democratic Republic of Congo by 60%, and to South Sudan, where millions are facing famine, by more than half. Stark warnings were issued by international charities following the vote, including Kirsty O'Neill, Executive Director of Policy, Advocacy and Campaigns for Save the Children. O'Neill said simply, children will die as a result. We have seen already the immense damage caused in some of the world's poorest and most fragile countries, from 40% cuts in aid for Yemen to 85% cuts in British support for family planning, she added. The vote today means that the cuts will not stop there, faced by the biggest humanitarian crisis in a generation. The UK has stepped back when it needed to step up, and the consequences will be felt for years to come. In April, the United Nations Population Fund, UNFPA, said the funding being withheld this year by the UK would have prevented 250,000 maternal and infant deaths, 14.6 million unplanned pregnancies, and 4.3 million unsafe abortions. The UNFPA's condemnation was echoed recently by Global Action for Peace and Security, which had called on MPs to reject the aid cuts and warned they would have devastating and disproportionate impact on millions of women and girls. Some charities noted that pulling back billions of dollars in aid each year represented a reversal of Johnson's campaign pledge to lead a global Britain. Describing the vote's result as a disaster for the world's poorest people, Oxfam Great Britain chief executive Danny Srinkajra warned that amid the coronavirus pandemic, aid is needed more than ever. We are seeing a yawning gap between the rhetoric of global Britain to reality of a government breaking its promise to the world's poorest and further undermining UK's credibility on the international stage, he added. These cuts won't balance the books. The government is putting politics above the lives of the world's most vulnerable communities. The 333 MPs who voted in favor of the cuts should know that blood is on their hands, said Daniel Willis, campaigns and policy manager at Global Justice Now. Today, claims of Global Britain ring hollow. Conservative leaders who spoke out against the cuts included former Prime Minister Sir John Major, who slammed Johnson's Ministry of Defense for funding a national yacht amid the withdrawal of aid, and former Secretary of State for Brexit, David Davis. Such a choice is morally reprehensible, David said of the plan. Let's be clear about it. Morally reprehensible. The results of the recent vote, Global Justice Now said, represents a deliberate attack on the idea of internationalism. The organization tweeted, a truly shameful day.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
By escalating raids against the resistance factions, the United States of America is venturing to tilt the Iraqi position decisively towards the demand for a complete American withdrawal, as well as providing a strong incentive for the factions to escalate in return. The pace of escalation is rising day after day against American interests in Iraq at a time when Mustafa al-Qadhimi's government is preparing to start the fourth round of the strategic dialogue, which will discuss a complete withdrawal of the American occupation forces instead of scheduling the withdrawal as agreed upon in the third round held last April. This shift in the Iraqi position came against the backdrop of the exchange of bombings between the Americans and the resistance factions, which began from mid-June and reached the 28th of June, when an American raid targeted a camp belonging to the Popular Mobilization Forces on the border strip between Syria and Iraq. The raids of the American occupation come to save Washington's face, especially after the repeated attacks that confused the Biden administration, in addition to the security and military losses suffered by his troops. It is now clear that the purpose of the Americans' continued escalation is to drag the Iraqi factions into an all-out war inside Baghdad and then in areas south of Iraq to create internal chaos. It's worth noting that since Biden took office at the beginning of this year, most of the American bombing operations have targeted the Iraqi resistance factions inside Syria, where they operate in coordination with the Syrian Arab Army. This explains the importance of the region for Washington, especially as it represents the soft loin that Daesh exploits to restore its activity. Hence, ladies and gents, behold the American Air Force being used again as Daesh ISIS Air Force simply to keep Syria destabilized. The Iraqi resistance factions have retaliated by launching about 12 attacks on American occupation bases in Iraq since last February. This will for sure represent real pressure for the Iraqi government to resolve the issue of the U.S. occupation as soon as possible before the ball of confrontation rolls and burns what is left of American interests on Iraqi soil. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The pace of escalation is rising day after day against American interests in Iraq at a time when Mustafa al-Qadhimi's government is preparing to enter the fourth round of the strategic dialogue, which will discuss a complete withdrawal of the American occupation forces, instead of scheduling the withdrawal as agreed upon in the third round held last April. Now, this shift in the Iraqi position came in light of the exchange of fire between the American occupation and the resistance factions, which began in June when an American raid targeted a camp belonging to the Hashd al-Shaabi on the border strip between Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, the American embassy in Baghdad was then targeted hours after American interests in western Iraq and other areas in neighboring Syria were similarly bombed. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, by escalating these raids against the resistance factions in Iraq, the U.S. is venturing to tilt the Iraqi position decisively towards the full demand of a full withdrawal from Iraqi soil. Now, if the withdrawal is the ultimate goal for real for the American occupation, why are the Biden administration and the U.S. forces escalating their fire against the Iraqi resistance?
First of all, we have to take into account that the escalation came after the negotiations between the Iraqi government and the U.S. administration has led nowhere. So here we have a situation in which the Americans sometimes say they are withdrawing, sometimes they say they are preparing to have the training courses for the Iraqi armed forces and the Iraqi police, and etc. Other times you see them barricading in their embassy, which is a huge size of the land in Baghdad. So you cannot be sure about this issue that the Americans want to withdraw. Now, when you deal with a country as such, this means you are telling the people of this country that you are an occupation force, and consequently they are going to deal with you as such. So the Americans all the time are trying to portray the issue as that the Iranians are the Iranian-backed militias are targeting our interests and our bases in Iraq. If you note how much they pump this propaganda war in this regard, you will understand that people are tending to forget that the Americans are an occupation force in Iraq, and consequently they are going to be dealt with likewise, meaning mm-hmm. as an occupation force. So these are the main things that we need to take into account whenever we are tackling the issue. Now, you see that the Americans are getting a lot of strikes from the Iraqi resistance. We need to underline the word resistance because there's an occupation force, and consequently they cannot retaliate with the way that, for instance, Trump would have wanted. And even if Trump was there, and I mean the Trump administration, the American army would not and the American Navy would not agree to an escalation because they know about their weaknesses in Iraq. They know about their weaknesses that have come in the last decade in the region and in the whole world in general.
Mr. Mohammed, what's very interesting is that since the beginning of this year, we have seen more than 50 attacks. One were actually said that happened by the U.S. administration. Others they were silent about that targeted U.S. interests in Iraq, especially the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, the Iraqi military bases that house U.S. troops in them, and the Erbil airport as well. We all remember that. In attacks often always attributed to the Iraqi resistance forces. In the event these attacks just increase and continue targeting U.S. occupation forces in Iraq, how do you think that the Iraqi government will maneuver around this fact in the upcoming talks?
Well, you have to take into account the complications that Mr. Kazemi is facing. You know, the Kazemi is what sort of a figure that was chosen to be in the middle between all parties, and you cannot be such a person and such a politician when you have a very complicated situation as the one in the Middle East in general, and specifically in Iraq, between all these forces that are around you. I mean, the Islamic Republic of Iran neighboring you, and you have the American administration and American troops occupying Baghdad. You have the Saudis intervening from here or there. You have other Gulf countries also. So it's a very complicated situation. And you notice that the Iraqi government is trying to please everyone. Whenever an American strike takes place, they criticize, for instance, slightly. But when the resistance retaliates, they try to make the those who carried out the operation as people who are not known, etc. Mm-hmm. So they are in a very, very in a real dilemma in this regard, in order how to deal with issues, because the issues are going in a very fast pace, and they cannot deal with the situation because of all of its old complications.
Well, it should be noted there, Mr. Muhammad, that since the Biden administration took the presidency in the U.S. At the beginning of this year, most of the American bombing campaigns have targeted the factions, Iraqi factions, Iraqi resistance inside Syria, where they coordinate with the Syrian Arab Army their operations there, because it is the perfect spot, the soft loin that Daesh, ISIS, usually exploits to try and restore its activity. How on earth does the world not condemn the U.S. basically being Daesh Air Force there? They are playing the role of protecting the area for ISIS to return to that area. How does the world just keep silent?
Well, the world is keeping silent because of the American hegemony over the media all over the world. And so the things are quite clear in this regard. I mean, even when you go back to the times when I know this has been reiterated a lot, the Trump declaration that it was Clinton who created Daesh, and on the issue of the scandal of the emails, etc. But still, the whole world knows, and even Iraqis sometimes had videotapes and footage of the American helicopters just withdrawing the ISIS militiamen from certain areas and moving them to other areas. So the whole world knows, but remains silent, as is the case with the Palestinian issue, which is completely a just cause, and the whole world is turning the blind eye to that, the Israeli massacres, and the situation in Lebanon with the American pressures and so that are starving people here. So all over the world you have right is right and wrong is wrong, and things are right clear, but unfortunately the American administration is sort of terrorizing and bullying all the media and all over the world, and all the politicians all over the world. Some of them subdue to the pressure, others reject this, and consequently would be confronting the American interests and American plans. But unfortunately, most of the world is just subduing to these pressures by the Americans.
Well, the dilemma of the White House is that it sees maintaining a small, what they call a focused mission inside of Iraq and inside of Syria as well, a worthwhile alternative to a complete full withdrawal of their forces. Yet obviously the Iraqi resistance will not stop its fight back. They will always keep targeting the U.S. occupation forces as long as they remain there. And obviously we've seen similar attacks against their bases in Syria as well. How do you think the Iraqi resistance will receive a possible decision by the U.S. to relocate from Baghdad and maybe go forward northwards Kurdistan? How will they deal with that?
Well, I'm sure also the strategists I'm not going only to talk about the Iraqi resistance here, I'm talking about the axis of resistance in the whole region, is reading very clearly the strategic weaknesses that have grown up and grown in the as far far as the American administration is concerned, in the whole region and in the whole world in general. We are talking about military-wise and economically and in many other domains. So you have to take into account all these things and disregard whatever the Americans are trying to spread in their propaganda and in their media about their aim to help and assist the poor Iraqi people. They are trying to assist us here in Lebanon, I mean, with besieging us and banning us from getting any necessities that we need to live as a people. So the Americans are doing one thing and on the one hand, and quite the opposite on the other, and while all the time claiming to be the force of good in the whole world, which is the utmost contrast of truth and
Well, I want to thank
difference.
You very much, Mr. Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for joining us to talk about the latest attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Iraq and possibly also in the future in Syria. Thank you very much for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the life and the loss of a Palestinian leader in Damascus. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
A fighter. This is how Ahmad Jibril spent his stormy life, witnessing the smallest details of the Palestinian struggle ever since the Zionist gangs of the first settlers uprooted the pillars of his family home in the village of Yazur near Jaffa in 1948 when he was just 10 years old. Since then, Jibril finally chose to cover his face with the dust of Damascus after he had discovered the secrets of geography between Palestine and the Levant interior, and learned the language of the water flowing towards the south with bullets and longing to return to the basil and lemon gardens in Yazur. Jibril was laid to rest in his beloved Damascus last week after decades of struggle for liberation that seems today closer than ever because of the thoughts and activism of the likes of late Ahmad Jibril. More in the following report.
On a sad day, July 7, 2021, a great Palestinian icon, Ahmad Jibril Abu Jihad, one of the founders of the contemporary Palestinian Revolution and the Palestine Liberation Organization, passed away in Damascus. With his departure, the Palestinian National Movement and the Palestinian people, as well as the Arab and Islamic nation and the free people of the world, lost a stubborn fighter who did not know despair nor submission. The idea of fighting for Palestine persisted over Jibril's purpose in life. Instead of pursuing higher education, he joined the Syrian army and moved to the military college in Cairo to graduate as a combat lieutenant. Jibril quickly used his knowledge in order to build a force of Fidayeen, fighters for Palestine, to revenge the taking of Palestine by illegal settlers and the Zionist occupation army. He contributed to the establishment of the Palestine Liberation Front and then the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Jibril's bias towards geography was a sufficient reason to establish the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command in 1968 and to separate from the Popular Front and before it from the Fatah movement and its leader Yasser Arafat. He instead chose an alliance with the late President Hafez al-Assad in 1970, an alliance that Jibril remained loyal to until he descended on Friday, July 7, under the soil of the cemetery of the martyrs in Yarmouk camp, south of Damascus. Throughout the years of conflict, the general command did not miss the fateful battles. From fighting at home in Palestine to confronting the enemy in Lebanon, Jibril planned, organized, led, and won most of the battles he fought. From the hotel war against the forces of the Lebanese front at that time, which was fought in Beirut with the support of the occupation army, to facing the 1982 invasion of Lebanon on most of the battlefronts, from the south to the coastal line to the capital and Hamdoun to the central Biqa, a especially in the famous battles of Sultan Yaqub to the famous Mountain War, in which the general command and the Syrian artillery were involved with great influence, so the battle against the Lebanese forces militia was decided at the time. As for the icon of Jibril's achievements, it was the glider's operation in 1987, which aimed to reach an occupation camp in the Galilee using gliders launched from Lebanon. This military achievement was one of the reasons for the outbreak of the First Intifada that year, in which Jibril and the general command played a prominent role in fueling it and providing it with moral and material support. Ahmed Jibril excelled in everything. His deep political vision prompted him to root the general command's relations with the various resistance factions and parties that engaged in fighting, especially Hezbollah and the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, where they all carried out several joint operations. Ahmed Jibril did not leave his two sons, Jihad and Khalid, trust funds and palaces. Rather, they inherited a life project that ends with death solely for Palestine. Now, to discuss the life of this brave man with us from Damascus is Mr. Tahseen Al-Halabi, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Tahseen. Now, late Ahmed Jibril's bias towards geography was a sufficient reason to establish the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the General Command, in 1968. How do you view the contribution of late Jibril to the fight to liberate Palestine?
You know, in the beginning, Comrade Jibril, he vowed all his life for Palestine, for liberating Palestine. And he also vowed the lives of his four children for Palestine, for liberating Palestine. He lost one, Jihad, the oldest one, as a revenge from the Israeli occupation when they targeted him in Beirut on 2002 in Beirut, because they knew that he was the one that sent from the Sea of Beirut to Gaza lot of weapons and lot of explosives and rockets for the revolution, for the resistance of the Palestinian factions in Gaza. Mm-hmm. Jibril's legacy really is very rich, very also deep in the roots of this resistance. From the beginning, he found that there was no way but to go to the military academy on 1957 to Egypt. In the beginning, he went to he volunteered to the Syrian army, and he made course for to be an officer, and then he requested to go to the Academy of Cairo in order to get more knowledge about guerrilla warfare, not for conventional armies and conventional weapons for armies. He went there in order to get the background of military activities, of military operations, and then he turned by himself to the knowledge of the expertise of the guerrilla warfare. For this reason, he was the one that graduated from the Academy of Egypt in the specialty of mines and engineering military positions and wireless also communications.
Well, Mr. Tahseen, in relation to the current events happening at the moment as we speak in occupied Palestine, how do you think the mental mull of Ahmed Jibril can affect the current wave of revolution against the occupation and also against the police state now cracking down on the Palestinian natives?
Jibril knew his road very well, and he knew the ways of how to confront the occupation forces. Therefore, when the Oslo Accords was signed by PLO leadership and Israel. He was the one that called all the Palestinian masses inside occupied Palestine to protest, to be against such accords, and to try to make any way to go to the road of resistance. From that moment, he started to receive hundreds of Palestinian youth from West Bank and Gaza Strip in Damascus, in the headquarters of the PFLP General Command, and they were trained here for a few weeks or more than 2 months from Hamas and from Jihad Islami. Many young Palestinian individuals, Palestinian fidaiyin, came here to his headquarters in Damascus, in Syria, and were getting all the making how of explosives, of weapons, of rockets, of a lot of things. And so he made certain
he basically embodied the real resistance of the Palestinians.
In front of them.
Mr. Tahsin, Jibril believed that Palestine is an Arab issue, and he rejected all attempts to isolate it from its Arab depth because of his belief that the liberation of Palestine is an Arab task and not only a Palestinian task. Because the Zionist danger does not threaten the Palestinian people alone, it threatens all of us and even goes past the Arab world. Where do you see the current Arab position from all the new changes happening inside Palestine right now?
From the beginning, he knew very well that no faction alone or with other factions, with other Palestinian factions, can liberate Palestine by his own capabilities and military equipments and military activities. He knew that the Palestinian factions should be the spear of the Arab armies that will participate in any war against the occupation forces inside Palestine. He wanted that those factions to be the pioneers on the road of guerrilla war against the Israeli occupation, whether inside Palestine or across the borders, from Jordan, from the Golan Heights boundaries, from South Lebanon, from Gaza, from all those boundaries surrounding Palestine. He tried to prepare such activities and giving trainings, military trainings for hundreds of Palestinians in order to do that. But not believing at all that the only Palestinian factions can liberate Palestine. He needed the Arab armies surrounding Palestine, occupied Palestine, to participate and to share with this victorious war against
Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi. Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, a political commentator, we celebrate today a man like Mr. Ahmed Jibril, and we celebrate men like you who have a great history in a struggle against the Zionist occupation on the road to the freedom of Palestine. Thank you very much for joining us from Damascus to celebrate with us this fallen hero. Thank you very much for being with us, and please stay tuned next week for more from our Mideast stream.
In the limelight.
A new study of Gaza's reconstruction needs, published by the UN, EU, and World Bank, demonstrates anew the harmful role played by these institutions in Palestine. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Murphy, senior editor of the Electronic Intifada. This article is published under the heading UN, EU, and World Bank Back Siege on Gaza. Stay tuned for more. A new study of Gaza's reconstruction needs published by the UN, EU, and World Bank demonstrates anew the harmful role played by these institutions in Palestine. The authors of the rapid damage and needs assessment, as the UN, EU, and World Bank called their study, go to great lengths to minimize Israeli regime responsibility for the dire situation in Gaza, exacerbated by the latest episode of bombardment in May. They use the passive voice throughout in an approach bid to downplay the Zionist regime's direct role in the destruction, for which reconstruction will cost some $345 to $485 million and take 2 years to complete. That is assuming Israeli regime won't obstruct it at every turn. Israeli regime leaders have sought to condition reconstruction on the return of Israelis held in Gaza. Rebuilding took place at a snail's pace after the last war, so there is every reason to believe that it will delay and hinder rebuilding once again.